Without further ado, our panel is Sophie Stowers, our own researcher here at UK in a Changing Europe, Paula Surridge, Deputy Director, UK in a Changing Europe and University of Bristol, and Rob Ford, Senior Fellow from UK in a Changing Europe and University of Manchester. So I'm going to get cracking quickly, Sophie, before something else goes wrong, and just say, what for you was the key takeaway of the elections last week?
I'm going to say something that I've never said before. I think for me, it was probably how sort of unsurprising the results were. I think a lot of what happened was just confirming sort of trends that we've seen in the national data, and sort of I think that meant a lot of people's predictions were quite spot on. I think the big thing to take away from it is that even though Labour is doing clearly very well, overturning a massive majority in Selby, if you look at the swing in Uxbridge, you know, it was a very close result, but the swing wasn't huge. It was about 7%, and I think they would have been hoping for more than that. So I think it just shows that even though, you know, Labour can be quite confident, they've still got to be cautious, and there is still work to do in seats like Uxbridge that are probably on the periphery of Labour's target list seats, but, you know, they still want to make inroads. There's still work to do.
Brill. Thank you. Paula?
I think, for me, I've got a little bit of an obsession with looking at what the smaller parties were doing, and I think the, again, underperformance of the smaller parties to the right of the Conservatives was really noticeable in these. In a seat like Selby, if Reform UK were doing as well as national polls suggest, taking, you know, 10-15% of 2019 Conservative votes, they should be doing much, much better in a seat like Selby at a by-election, and they're not. And that suggested to me that there's not really a credible threat to the Conservatives on their right-hand flank. Now, you could argue that's because they've moved to that space, so there's no space for anybody on their right-hand flank. But the idea that they would react to that by moving further to the right seems to me to be rather foolish. And I think it suggests, my kind of big takeaway is that it suggests the national polling's probably not far off for Labour and the Conservatives, but it's underestimating the potential impact of the Lib Dems, where there's a tactical situation and people will turn out to vote for them, and possibly overestimating the potential threat from Reform UK.
Okay, now just quickly, I mean, how different does that situation become if Nigel Farage comes back, or does that not make a difference?
It probably boosts Reform UK a little bit. But if the less they can get across some sort of policy platform that's more in tune with those voters, I think they're still going to struggle. Their mood music, their policy announcements and so on are very out of step with where people perceived UKIP as being back in 2015. And so I think that it might raise that a little bit, but I don't think it's going to raise it all the way up to where we were in 2015.
Okay. And Rob, any thoughts?
Well, my sort of big takeaway would be we still seem to be on course for a Labour government at the next general election, but it's not entirely clear what sort of Labour government that would be. If you average together the swings from Selby and Uxbridge, you get an average swing of 15.2 points. If you average together the most recent polls from all the independent pollsters currently operating, you get a swing of 15.2 points. So what that shows is that Uxbridge and Selby are both within the realm of possible results with an average swing of 15 points. But if Labour underperforms a little, then we have a hung parliament, but the Conservatives have no friends in the current parliament, so it's probably Prime Minister Starmer. If we get an overperformance along the line of Selby, then you're potentially looking at a very strong Labour majority. And all stations in between are still potentially in play.
Excellent. Thank you. It's a really interesting question, actually, from Anonymous. And incidentally, for those who are new to these things, if you go onto Slido, you can put your questions on there, but you can also, and I'd be grateful if you did, vote for the questions that you want me to pose to the panel, and they will rise to the top of my screen like magic and save me having to sort of scroll all the way down. But this question from Anonymous is anti-Green the new Brexit for the Conservatives?
No, it would be my answer if I can offer one. I think there's been an awful lot of overinterpretation of what happened in Uxbridge with ULEZ. I mean, this was a situation that was almost custom built to produce an unusually large protest reaction. It's a by-election. You get more local protest votes in by-elections. This is not the first where that kind of thing has happened. It was a by-election held 1 month away from when the ULEZ expansion happens. So that's the point when voter awareness of it is highest, but voter awareness that it won't affect most of them is lowest. So that maximises the effect. And it took place in a part of London that was very against Sadiq Khan in the last London elections, a borough of London that swung, you know, not in this to the same extent to Labour as the rest of London did, and where Sadiq Khan isn't popular. Put that all together, and you have a situation where a kind of localised reaction to a local policy could be quite strong. But there's been quite a lot of polling out in the past few days that underlines the point that green policies on the whole are still very popular. In addition, we saw in the by-elections, you know, in True Blue, or formerly True Blue, Somerton, there was a 10-point vote for the Greens. It's very odd that when you see a big swing to the Greens in a safe Conservative seat, the Conservative reaction is, green policies are the new Brexit. Well, only if you mean there's a party out there taking votes from you because you're not doing enough on it, which isn't quite the conclusion they're drawing.
Paula or Sophie?
I agree with Rob. We've seen green swings toward the Greens in Conservative rural areas in local elections as well. I mean, the idea that there's a majority anti-green in the public that you can somehow swoop together like on Brexit just isn't the case. There's widespread support for green policies. I think where the distinction lies is who pays. That's where there's a distinction. But I don't think that necessarily helps the Conservatives, because voters think big business should pay, and that's not really where they are in terms of thinking about it.
Okay. Sophie, do you shake your head? All right. I mean, actually, one thing I wanted to touch on is turnout at these things, and in two ways, I think. Firstly, given the low turnout, to what extent can we extrapolate from these results to a general election? And secondly, some people have made a lot of the fact that Tory voters didn't vote. So it's not that Tory voters switched, but Tory voters decided to stay at home. And some Tories are trying to draw solace from that, saying, well, look, all we need to do is persuade those supporters of ours to come out in a general election, because there isn't any sign of them voting for other people. Is there any basis of fact to that? Or what do you make of those sort of claims?
I go first, because I've got some relevant figures written down.
Oh, excellent.
So first of all, turnout of by-elections is always lower. It's usually about 2/3 of the turnout at a general election.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, it's a little bit lower than we would expect, but not massively so. So if you take the 75% at Somerton down to 44% in Somerton, we would have expected it to go 75-50. So it's not a massive margin of difference. It looks like a huge stay at home, but compared to other by-elections, it's not necessarily the case. We can't tell. There is no way of telling from the data whether it was Conservative voters that stayed home or not. We could all get into some ecological fallacies about that if we wanted to. We don't know that for sure. But having said that, the current YouGov polling, whether the questions where they ask people on a 0 to 10 scale, how likely are you to turn out to vote? 2019 Conservative voters are significantly lower on that measure than 2019 Labour or Lib Dem voters. So there is something there about Conservative voters being less likely to turn out. And that suggests, though, that it might affect a general election to the same extent as the by-election. So it's not necessarily a comfort to the Conservatives if that's what the polling's picking up.
I can also add a few numbers, as I like to Paula's numbers. So, I mean, this argument, we're all right because our voters are just staying home and all we need to do is turn them out. I mean, that does strike me as a little bit of a life raft argument. You know, you're splashing around, you're drowning, you just grab anything that's available. This is about the only thing that you can say that doesn't make Selby look awful, so you say that. I mean, by-elections, incumbent parties voters stay home, opposition parties voters don't, you get big swings to the opposition. That is almost always what happens. There's always swings to the opposition, but how big? And if you look at the sort of parliaments since 1945, in parliaments where the opposition goes on to government, the average swing to the opposition is about 4 points. In governments where the opposition goes on to win and there's a change of government, the average swing is 9 points. So far this parliament, the average swing for Labour is about 7 or 8 points, but the average swing since Partygate by-elections is about 11 points. And the swing in Selby was 23.7 points. So it's very, very hard to point to that result and some of the other recent results and say, we can turn things around by turning out voters more. Because that, you know, I'm sure they were saying that in 1995 as well, or in 1968. It didn't save them. So I don't really think there's a lot to that argument. This is a pattern we see through history. It's a reason to take by-elections with a pinch of salt. But even with that pinch of salt, these don't look like great results for the Conservatives.
Excellent. Sophie?
I suppose the other thing is the result in Somerton and the Liberal Democrats. Obviously, there was such a big swing there. And I suppose one thing that Conservatives will be trying to take comfort from is that we do know that the Liberal Democrats do particularly well in by-elections. They're a strong campaigning machine in them, and in the same way that they are in locals, particularly in that part of the country. And when you look at national polls, it doesn't necessarily look like there's that kind of swing at a national level. That they've been about 11, 12, I think, sort of nationally pretty consistently. But I think, as Paula said, there is the risk that the vote for all small parties is being underestimated at a national level. And also you have had that rise in votes for a party like the Greens. So it does suggest that even in those sort of more rural seats in the southwest, there's going to be a fight there, in the same way that there's going to be in a lot of these sort of urban seats in the north. There's almost like a pincer effect for the Conservatives. They're going to have to almost fight two sort of different types of election campaign in the country, depending where they are, which I think makes their situation even more difficult.
Interesting. And actually, Rob, I know you and the sort of BBC election team, I saw your slides after the local elections. There were two particularly interesting slides that I want to sort of dig down on a little bit. The first was a slide that showed very clearly just how strong tactical voting was in the local elections. So, you know, the Lib Dem vote goes up significantly in those seats where the Lib Dems are second. Same for the Labour in seats where Labour are second. Is there evidence that tactical voting is more systematic and widespread now than it has been? And is there any evidence? I mean, you seem to be saying there was a bit of evidence of that from the locals. Was there evidence of that in the by-elections as well?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question, Anand, and quite a few seats at the next general election may well turn on the answer to this question. I should caveat that the average swings I just was citing, that those kind of dodge the tactical voting question, because that's just in Conservative versus Labour or Labour versus Conservative seats. So when it's Conservative versus Lib Dem, what we often see is the Labour vote going down, and that's often evidence of tactical voting. That does seem to be getting stronger in recent local election cycles, and there's pretty strong evidence for it in all three of the elections we had here. We had two seats that were clearly billed as Conservative versus Labour contests, and in both of those seats the Lib Dem vote fell sharply. Then we had a third seat that was a clear Conservative versus Lib Dem contest, and the Labour vote plummeted. And what that does suggest is that supporters of both of those parties are very willing to back whichever is strongest locally in terms of getting rid of their Conservative MP. The last time we saw really strong tactical coordination of this kind was in the early New Labour elections. Most of the research on those elections suggested that delivered quite a few extra seats for both parties at those contests. I don't have the figures in my memory once, but double digits, substantial double digits. And when you look, partly because there hasn't been so much of that in recent election cycles, there are quite a lot of seats where, say, the Lib Dems are second and there's a big Labour vote to squeeze, or Labour are second and there's a big Lib Dem vote to squeeze. So that there are quite a lot of places where this could make a big difference. The only caveat I would put on this is to come back to the Greens again. Now, another way of interpreting the Green vote is that these may be votes that are broadly anti-Conservative, but they're not willing necessarily to prioritise getting rid of the Conservatives over, say, the global climate crisis. And that could be a thorn in the side for Labour in some places if it continues to happen. And one question they may want to ask themselves is, how do we make sure we keep Green voters on side? Because it's no good picking up three Lib Dem voters if you lose two voters to your Green left at the same time. You're not going to get the tactical advantage that you hope to. And that indeed is another reason why they shouldn't overreact to what's happened in Uxbridge. It's not a strategy, you know, distancing oneself from all Green policies is not a strategy without downside potentially for Labour.
Sophie or Paula, do you want to come on this sort of tactical voting question?
Yeah, I think one of the things I would add, that you need a certain set, aside from the fact that you need the kind of way our election system functions, you also need a certain set of circumstances for tactical voting. I'm not I'm not even sure that's the right phrase for it, but for this kind of squeezing of the vote to get rid of the government incumbent, you need a certain set of circumstances to be in play, which I think we have in play right now. We probably had in play in 97. We didn't have it in 2019. We didn't have it in 2017. And that is, firstly, you need a really unpopular government that people want to get rid of, so that not voting expressively for the party that you most support doesn't feel like a problem, because you know you're going to get rid of the person that you dislike the most. So you need that to be in play. But then you also need to be in play a kind of meh-ness between the two other parties. So, you know, if you've got a very
unpopular
government, but you've also got a very unpopular main opposition, then those third party voters won't go there. And we saw that, I think, to some extent in 2019, and to some extent in 2017. So you need those forces in play. And I think we do probably have that at the moment, that desire to get rid of a very unpopular government and not being too concerned about the other options is probably in play. We also need to have got to a point, I think, and I think we have got to this point, where Labour voters, to some extent, have forgiven the Lib Dems for the coalition. And that took some time as well. So Labour voters weren't going to vote Lib Dem because they hadn't forgiven them for the 2010-2015 period. But now, post-Brexit, post the kind of joining together in people's vote and so on, there's a bit more appetite for that cooperation again between those parties.
And I suppose the flip side is Lib Dem voters are reassured post-Corbyn that Labour aren't what Labour were. Yeah. I suppose, I mean, if we're talking about tactical voting, a Nadine Dorries by-election would be interesting, wouldn't it? Because it's not immediately clear who stands down. I mean, we haven't got a by-election yet. I'm freaking out slightly because on Slido I've got a questions about Nadine Dorries going from Timothy Barrow, and I immediately thought the National Security Advisor is sending me questions about Nadine Dorries. I assume it's not him. It's a different Timothy Barrow. But any thoughts on what might happen there, given the fact that both Labour and Lib Dem seem to think that they can win it? I mean, does that change the equation? Would you expect, in the heat of a campaign, for things to clarify? I know it's a hideously unfair question to ask you all, but that won't stop me.
I'll have a first go, if you like, Alan, because I was discussing this with somebody on Twitter earlier this morning, a Lib Dem activist, I think, because I said, well, if the swing in Selby was replicated, Labour would also win Mid-Bedfordshire, where they are second. And they said, oh, but Mid-Bedfordshire is a Lib Dem target. And they meant it in the same way as North Shropshire was a Lib Dem target. The Lib Dems are starting third, but they think, for various reasons, this is a Tory vote that would be more amenable to them than to Labour. And I think Labour could end up being victims of their own success in Selby, in that it may be much harder now to say, let's just leave the field to the Lib Dems in this seat, than it would have been pre-Selby. It's much harder, I think, for the leadership to quite, because Labour, for all sorts of constitutional and internal party reasons, will never just say, we're not fighting this seat. They'll always say publicly, we're fighting this seat, we fight to win in every seat, yada, yada, yada. But tacitly, behind the scenes, they can make more or less effort in particular seats. And it will be harder to turn around to local parties and activists and say, we're not going to fight very hard in Mid-Bedfordshire, even though we start in a clear second, because we think these Tory voters will prefer to go to the Lib Dem, even if they think that's the case. Now, there's another question, is it the case? I mean, in Bedfordshire, you've got Luton, which is Labour. You've got Bedford, which is Labour. It's short commute from London, which is Labour-leaning and stuffed with Labour activists. So you'd say Labour might be keener to fight it even if they hadn't won Selby. But then the question becomes, well, will the Lib Dems, who have been getting very excited about it, be willing to stand aside if they've not got anywhere else to campaign in? It's an interesting puzzle for both parties, I think.
Yeah. Should we have that by-election?
Should we have it? Yeah.
Sophie, do you want to add anything on this, on the Mid-Bedfordshire?
I just think another thing interesting way to look at it is how the Conservatives fight it because of the particular circumstances of that seat. You know, obviously Nadine Dorries is a huge defender of Boris Johnson, and it would be, I think, quite a scalp for Rishi Sunak if the Conservatives were to hang on to that. It would be a sort of repudiation of everything she's been saying, and a sort of a symbolic show that he has a hold over the Conservative Party, and it's no longer, you know, the Boris Johnson Conservative Party. So I think it will be quite interesting to see the amount of effort and resources that the Tories were channeling, particularly if they think that that split of the vote between the Lib Dems and Labour would let them keep hold of it. And I think that will be quite interesting.
Paula, anything?
Yeah, I think there's one other thing I'd add to that. I agree with what everybody said. But it might be, this is going to get me shouted at on Twitter, but I'll go for it anyway.
Excellent.
It might be that actually the Lib Dems and Labour fighting each other and the Conservatives holding it is a better outcome for Labour and the Lib Dems, because it might focus minds then on not fighting each other and where they shouldn't fight each other and what the act. We saw this in the previous parliament when the Lib Dems, I think it was Brecon, I'm not very good with constituency names, where the Lib Dems took the seat, but it was clear that if the Brexit Party hadn't stood, the Conservatives probably would have kept it. And that focused Brexit Party minds on what might happen in an awful lot of southern seats where that vote could get split. So it might be that actually fighting each other and seeing that that doesn't work might be a good outcome for cooperation for the next election.
I mean, in a way, this talk of potential Labour-Lib Dem competition sort of brings me a little bit to Brexit. But I'll do it in two parts. I mean, the first part is, again, the work you did on the locals, Rob. I think John Curtis wrote an interesting blog saying that in terms of Brexit, we're more in 2017 than in 2019 when it comes to the degree to which Brexit is changing the vote. Has that, did that change in these by-elections? Was Brexit there at all? Could you see any element of the Brexit electoral impact? That's the first question. The second one is about Lib Dem policy, what it might do to Labour. I'll come on to that next. But
I mean, on the first question, all three of these seats were strongly Leave seats in 2016. I think they were all in the region of 56 to 60% Leave or something in that ballpark. So more Leave than the average. And to me, one of the remarkable things about Brexit in all three is that it just didn't warrant or merit a mention from anybody, it seemed. The Conservatives didn't really talk about it. Labour didn't really talk about it. The Lib Dems didn't talk about it. And the second thing is, it doesn't seem to have very much bearing on these results at all. I mean, in a sense, another way in which Labour can take a great deal of encouragement from Selby is this is a pretty Brexity, pretty Tory-leaning bit of the country, and they're getting a 20-point swing there. Yeah. If we look at the polling and we look at the local elections this year, we also see Labour's strongest performances coming with Leave voters and in Leave voting areas. And of course, that really matters for Labour's strategists, because they know that when you look at the electoral map of England and Wales, particularly, most of their target seats tend to be more Leave than the national average. So to do best where Leave is strong is exactly what you want, and does incidentally also point to something which I think Steve Fisher talked about after the local elections, which is a lot of our assumptions about how many seats Labour might get on a particular swing are based upon an idea that swing will be more or less the same everywhere, and that therefore the geographical disadvantage that Labour had in the last couple of elections will continue. But if Labour overperformed in Leave areas, then that geographical pattern changes and they no longer face the same disadvantage. Then you might end up with rather more seats than anticipated on the same swings, because they're getting the votes, you know, they're doing a Heineken, they're getting their appeal to reach exactly where it needs to reach. So that all is very encouraging for Labour and very worrying for the Conservatives, because it means what is already quite a dim picture in terms of national swings could be even worse if the geography underlying it is changing at the same time.
That is interesting. I mean, Sophie, this might be an opportunity to do a quick plug for the work you did with Public First on leavers, in the sense that actually, when, you know, insofar as they're changing their minds, they feel they've been let down by the Conservative government, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. But I think one thing I would say is I don't think it's necessarily a scenario where Leave voters have forgiven the Labour Party when it comes to Brexit, or they've come round to, you know, being Remainers and changed their mind. the big thing is just it's not a priority issue for even those who have been ardently Leave since 2016. It's just not a priority issue as we head into the next election, so it's just not come into play for them. But what our public affairs data does show is that for voters who do think, you know, Brexit is going badly or they're not happy with how it's gone so far, the two big factors are sort of either the current government or the current prime minister has not had the right priorities or has not implemented the kinds of Brexit I want. And the other lot sort of just say that there's not been enough time and like, you know, they're sort of undecided on it. So I think those two factors mean that they're either, you know, want to take it out on a government where the Brexit is the main priority still, they want to take it out on the sitting government, or they just don't really care this time around. It's just not a priority for them. And I think we see that when you look at sort of YouGov's or Ipsos's even issue tracker, it's just nowhere near the levels of concern that it was even 5 years ago. We're just not in the same scenario at all.
Yeah, I think it was 9% on the Ipsos one in June, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
Paula, on the Brexit issue?
Yeah, so I think the thing with the Brexit issue now is that the voters that it motivates the most are those that would want to rejoin, or the Remain voters. For it doesn't really motivate Leave voters in the same way. And if you're I think I'm going to preempt your next question here.
If you're
a highly motivated rejoiner, who do you vote for? There isn't anybody offering you that in the political landscape. So it can't move votes because it isn't being offered as a thing that voters can choose between. There isn't a choice there for those really motivators to make. So it can't be active as a political issue in terms of vote choice if in fact voters aren't being offered any kind of choice.
So go on then. I mean, in the context of what we were saying about Labour and the Lib Dems, if let's say Lib Dem conference this year, overwhelming pressure from the membership and the Lib Dems have to noisily adopt a policy of rejoining the single market and the customs union, is the implication of what you just said then that these diehard rejoiners in a Labour Tory marginal decide to vote Lib Dem because of Brexit to show their frustration about Brexit? Is that a potential game changer?
I don't think it's a potential game changer because I don't think there's enough of them, and they mostly live in seats where Labour have already got huge majorities anyway. So I don't think it's a potential game changer. I think it is that there's the potential there to change the dynamic, and that I think there's potential there for it to cost Lib Dems some of those seats where they're targeting the Conservative vote, kind of scaring away some of the Tory horses that might switch. But I don't think it's a danger to Labour necessarily because of where those motivated rejoin voters are.
But presumably it makes it harder to get away with the current policy of not talking about it.
Possibly, but we know voters don't particularly want to talk about it. So actually, that policy might still work quite well.
I mean,
go on, Rob.
If I can add to what Paul has just said, even if the Lib Dem activists did this at Lib Dem conference, and I'm going to say a couple of things that will probably have Lib Dem activists shouting at me on Twitter now. Firstly, most voters don't notice what the Lib Dems decide to do on most things most of the time, with the best will in the world, because they don't get the attention that the other parties do. So I can't see it becoming a major issue outside of the general election campaign. And secondly, the Lib Dems themselves post-Somerton may well have a strong incentive not to talk about their own party's politics or policy on Brexit, because look at the seats in the surrounding area to Somerton. Yeah. All historically liberal seats in the southwest, all Leave voting, very few passionate rejoiners down in that part of the world, but all of a sudden quite a lot of credible Lib Dem target seats. And the Lib Dems actually have a relatively, because unlike Corbyn in 2017, who couldn't avoid talking about Brexit in that campaign, it will not be difficult at all for the Liberal Democrats to avoid talking about Brexit in the general election campaign, even if it's official party policy. And if they've got a whole bunch of target seats that are quite Leave-leaning, where they now think they've got a chance, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the leadership decides, well, let's just leave that conversation until we're into the next parliament.
That's at Rob Ford Manx, for those of you who are interested. Sophie, did you want to chip in on this?
No.
Okay, there's quite a few questions coming in about Scotland, and we have another by-election coming up in Rother Glen. And I don't know if any of you have turned your mind towards this yet, or to the polling, or have started to speculate on what the Scottish electoral landscape might look like given what's happening to the SNP at the moment. But would any of you like to talk a bit about Rutherglen Glen and what your expectations are?
I'll give it a go because I have a kind of half finished thing that I've been trying to write about what might happen in Scotland. I mean, Scotland is not getting discussed enough, in my view, in the current political conversation, because the tectonic plates are shifting there in a way that they haven't in 9 years since the independence referendum. It's now more or less a dead heat between Scottish Labour and the SNP in the polling, which implies a very substantial SNP to Labour swing. Now, Rutherglen will bring the spotlight back onto this, and if that polling is at all correct, Labour should win it very comfortably because it's quite a marginal seat anyway. But the other factor in play in Scotland, which could make things even better for Labour, is there are quite a few sort of third-placed unionist votes. Let's imagine, and I'm not saying this is true, but let's imagine that for most Scottish voters, the current primary thing is pro or anti-SNP, pro or anti-independence. So that just as third place Lib Dems in some Selby might say, well, we really want to get rid of the Conservatives, third place Conservatives in central belt seats in Scotland will say, the thing I really want to do is finally get rid of these gnats who've been running the country since 2007 and they bang on about independence all the time. I'm fed up with it. And I'm willing even to vote for Scottish Labour to stop them, because the Scottish Tories are dead in the water anyway. They're not going to win. If you have that kind of tactical squeeze going on, that could deliver further extra seats to Labour in Scotland. And the more seats Labour pick up in Scotland, where the political conversation will be very different, the easier it will be to get an overall majority across Britain as a whole. It'll bring down the required swing quite substantially in England and Wales. So on the polling alone, Labour has reasons to be excited about Scotland. But if we add in the possibility that unionist voters might coordinate in a way similar to how anti-conservative voters are coordinating in England and Wales, and we saw evidence to some extent of this incidentally in the 2021 Scottish Parliament elections. There was some evidence that particularly third place Conservative voters were willing to do this. That could then further boost the number of seats Labour get out of that swing. So Scotland is potentially going to be very important in
that's surely a more compelling argument for a Holyrood election than a Westminster one, isn't it, for Tory voters? I mean, you're electing a UK government, and you know, voting Labour in those circumstances, where essentially the national picture is will the Labour or Tories form the next government, is a slightly different calculation, isn't it, to a Holyrood election?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely possible. I think the question that would need to be answered, and I've not seen polling on it, is how do the Scottish Tory voters rank their enemies in a Westminster election? Who winds them up more? An SNP MP banging on about independence at every single PMQs, or a Labour MP contributing to a Starmer government? And again, the Starmer versus Corbyn thing may come into this, because, I mean, there's going to be some Tory voters who are just true blue to the core and will be treating this as a Con versus Lab Westminster election. But there might be other Scottish Conservative voters who are, you know, maybe on the sort of more liberal end of the party, the same kind of people who've been going Lib Dem in the south of England, who will say, well, I don't particularly like the current Conservative Party anyway, and I really dislike the SNP, so maybe I'm willing to tactically vote Labour. I mean, but you're right, it's an easier calculation in a Scottish Parliament election than a Westminster election.
Paula or Sophie, anything to add on the by-election coming up, or Scottish politics more generally?
I read something by John Curtis today, which I thought was interesting, which was kind of showing that even though support for independence hasn't really shifted that much since sort of the whole investigation into the SNP's party finances and things began, support for the SNP and membership of the SNP has, which sort of raises the question of where are those voters going to, you know, if they're no longer going to support the SNP in the next election, do they just not vote? And I think a lot of that depends on, you know, what is those voters' priorities? Is it independence, or is it just voting for what they perceive to be a sort of progressive, more liberal, you know, party, and kind of how that comes into practice? Because if you're a pro-independence voter in Scotland, but, you know, you're put off by the ongoings into the SNP, where does your vote go? And I think a lot of that will depend on what their overarching preference is as you're going to the next election.
And again, the Greens, I suppose, is the obvious one. I have to say, for a fantastic moment then, I thought you were going to say, I just read something by John Curtis and I thought it was rubbish, but you didn't.
Paula.
No, I don't think I've got anything to add to that, really, in terms of insights from Scotland.
Okay.
Actually, Anna, one thing that Sophie just mentioned reminded me of something that I think has often been forgotten about 2015 to 17. In 2015, there was a really big increase in turnout in Scotland, which was very much the sort of passion of the independence campaign flowing into the following general. Yep. And then in 2017, one of the factors in the sort of very unusual Scottish result that time was that turnout wave went out again. A lot of voters stayed home. It looks like that may have particularly harmed the SNP. And one possible, I mean, we haven't discussed it actually. I mean, I've talked about tactical voting, but you know, you were mentioning before Tories staying home in by-elections. What if a lot of SNP voters say they're fed up with the behaviour of the SNP in government? They don't see any prospects of independence in the short term. They're relatively low engagement voters anyway. If they stay home in very large numbers, that could have a major impact, even if they don't go to anyone else.
Yeah. When is the by-election? It's September.
The petition result, I think the petition closes on the 31st of July, the end of this month. I don't know how long it is for the result to be announced. Assuming that the petition has been successful, and most of them have been so far, I don't know if Parliament has to then set a by-election date straight afterwards, and therefore we have to wait until after. We need one of the Parliament experts here to tell us what's going to happen. But I suspect it will probably be September.
That was my guess. Just quite a specific question, but an interesting one, which is what impact do we expect the boundary changes to have on all these calculations? Surely one of you has got the answer to this.
I don't have the answer to this because I haven't had a chance to really digest what's been written about the boundary changes. The one thing I would say about it, which is not an answer quite to that question, but is how it might play into those tactical calculations, because there will, and that kind of who's second, who's got the best chance between Labour and the Lib Dems, because there will be a lot of seats where we don't know that for sure, where it's being calculated from other results. And so those tactical decisions for voters may be more difficult than they would otherwise have been.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think the net effects are sometimes overestimated. There's a general thought that it'll help the Conservatives because the growing areas of the country tend to be a little bit Conservative leaning. But on the other hand, all those very Leave voting areas of North England and Midlands that the Conservatives picked up, those tend to be sort of areas that are shrinking or growing more slowly. So that offsets it to some extent. So I'm not sure it'll have a massive net impact on the overall balance of power in terms of Labour versus Conservative. But I suspect, and I haven't checked the figures on this, that probably the Remain bits of England are growing quicker and the Leave bits of England are more sort of slow growing, which may mean that kind of Leave lean in the electoral battleground might be reduced a little bit by the boundary changes. But I, like Paula, haven't crunched the numbers systematically yet, so that's unfounded speculation, Anand.
Okay, that's the sort of speculation I like. There's quite a few questions here about the sort of pincer movement and Labour in the sense of competing with the Conservatives and competing with the Greens. That's to say, you know, if you overreact on the Green policies, will Labour start losing votes to the Green Party? We've kind of touched on that, I think, already. I'm not sure we need to do it again, unless there's anything anyone wants to add. Is that a real issue for the Labour Party, do you think? The potential Green challenge?
I can go on that one if you'd like. Yes, at one level, in that there are lots of people amongst the 2019 Labour cohort of voters who would quite happily vote Green. But I don't think it's going to be a problem at this upcoming election, because I think the wave of get rid of the Conservatives will carry those voters into the Labour column in most places, and the places where it doesn't, Labour are so far ahead anyway that it's those city seats where it's probably not going to make a huge amount of difference. Where I think it will be coming into play is very quickly after the election, where then it's much more difficult for the Labour to, it's much more difficult for them to keep that obviously that anti-Conservative feeling then dissipates to a certain extent. There's not a government there to kind of rail against, and I think that's where it will become a more difficult problem to square that circle when you're actually in government and people are actually expecting you to do things.
Okay, anyone else want to come in on that? We touched on Brexit, but I suppose the other thing I wanted to touch on is a lot of talk in the newspapers about the Conservatives wanting to, you know, wage a culture war, and it's these cultural issues we want to focus on in the next election. I mean, given what we've said about Brexit and its salience, does that look like a sensible electoral strategy? But, I mean, particularly if we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis, do you think there are votes to be gained from that sort of approach?
I mean, I see one way in which it makes sense, but even then I have my doubts. The one way in which I think it makes sense is, you know, what has been the most electorally potent quote-unquote cultural war issue for the last 30 years, including in Brexit, including before Brexit? Immigration. And if you look at if you look at 2019 Conservative voters in particular, over the past year, they've become very concerned about immigration. So if your strategy, as Rishi Sunak, is let's put a firm floor on the Conservatives' vote, let's make sure it doesn't really collapse, let's keep Nigel Farage out of the next election, then a really hardline stance on immigration makes sense in terms of ticking those boxes in theory. However, it is basically giving up on the idea of competing for many of the swing voters that you're losing to Labour, because very few of them are now saying that immigration is a top issue, number one. Number two, they don't think that the Conservatives' policies are any good on immigration. And number three, even when they are pro-immigration control or pro-stop the boats, they think that the policies designed to do those things will be expensive failures. So you're essentially flagging up something people don't care about and where they think your policies are bad anyway in terms of the swing voters. So I don't really think it will work with them. And then when it comes to the broader quote-unquote cultural war, the kind of stuff we saw discussed at the National Conservative Conference and everything, I think there was any evidence at all that any of that stuff really exists in the mind of the electorate as a kind of meaningful set of issues outside of some very highly engaged activist sort of networks. And the risk if you start really going on about that stuff is you reinforce some of the negative elements of the current Conservative image, that they're angry, out of touch, not thinking about the country's main problems and only talking to themselves. So not only are these ineffective issues, but they're actually potentially actively harmful because they reinforce negative views that the public are already forming about you for other reasons.
Though on the immigration point, judging from the Prime Minister's Twitter feed yesterday, Number 10's thinking is slightly different to yours, isn't it? I mean, they clearly think there's something to be gained from banging this drum on immigration.
Well, as I said, there is a logical strategy. There is a logic to it if your strategy is let's firm up our core support. Yeah. Let's make sure we don't go below 28% or below 30% or whatever. Let's hold at least our core vote together, because the core vote, a lot of them do care about it. So, but is it an election winning strategy? I can't see much evidence in the polling that would support that. And unless we see a really drastic shift in public priorities in the next year, I can't see how making that your focal point would work.
Yeah, unless you believe that the sort of stay-at-home Tories are the key to the election victory, which, as you earlier said, is probably not the case. Sophie, do you want to come in on immigration at all?
I think only really just adding to what Rob said, which is that...
You can disagree with each other, and that's fine too.
Well, never. Just the point that I think if there's one sort of type of immigration, if you can classify that might be more of a vote winner, and that is more salient at the minute, it is illegal immigration at small boat crossings because of the importance of that idea of having a controlled, fair, sort of transparent migration system. And that is what sort of, I think, motivates a lot of people. And I think that is why we've seen immigration, which sort of dropped out of the top 10 priority issues for voters, has sort of slowly began to sort of creep back up. I think it's in third or fourth place on YouGov's tracker now, which is the highest it's been for a long time. But as Rob said, that of sort of making inroads with voters whose priority that is very dependent on taking action that works. And in the year that they've got, you know, till election year and a half, it's very unlikely that any sort of tangible difference is going to be made. So I think you are sort of setting a rough your own back if you put that as one of your five pledges on on the front of your podium. And you can't then actually do anything to tackle that issue. You're very much just reinforcing the public's attitudes to successive governments on this issue, which is just one of incompetence, really. So yeah, I'm not sure how good of a strategy it is.
Yeah, I mean, just adding to what Sophie said there, a previous Conservative Prime Minister and Home Secretary once set a very clearly defined goal on immigration and then very publicly failed to meet it. And those were the conditions in which Nigel Farage first took off in the polls. So if Rishi Sunak goes around saying, I'm going to stop the boats, and the boats don't stop, I mean, his hope is that this stops Farage from coming back onto the stage. On the other hand, it provides the ideal opening line to every Nigel Farage campaign speech. They said they would stop the votes. The boats haven't stopped. So there's a risk that it more than backfires, that it actually may end up encouraging the nightmare outcome that they're trying to avoid.
And of course, you know, the Tory manifesto in 2019 had that line, overall numbers will come down. So there was a numerical pledge there, even though they don't talk about it very much anymore. And of course, it's a pledge they failed to keep. And the bizarre thing about this debate is, you know, as the Prime Minister's out there doing these sort of Twitter threads about immigration, there's a debate going on in the heart of government about whether we need to liberalise the rules still further and get other people in. You know, the story in the Sunday Times about au pairs and baristas. So there's going to be sort of two parallel and contradictory conversations going on in government, let alone anywhere else at the moment. But Paula, is there anything you'd like to add on this?
Just to answer in a slightly different way, because I think you started out by framing it around the kind of conservative stay-at-home voters. And the biggest kind of group at the moment amongst the Conservatives, not the Conservative Labour switchers, they're not the Conservative Reform UK switchers, they're the Conservatives who don't know what they're going to do next time. It's running at almost a quarter of 2019 Conservative voters. So I would say that the core strategy for either side at the moment is to find out who those voters are and what they want. And I tried to do that with some of the election study data. And it's striking, really, that the thing that they're most concerned about that is the economy. You know, the most important issue for 70% of that group is the economy. But on the economy, on economic issues and values, they're well to the left of those that are staying with the Conservative Party. So, yeah, you can move around on the other dimension and try and have a culture war and bring immigration and so on in play. But when people's concerns are economic and they're not aligned with you on economic values, the idea of lowering taxes and so on, then it's not going to help you, because that you're not talking to people about the things that they really care about and that are really important to their lives at the moment.
Yeah, and I would point people towards some really good work done by Jane Green about economic insecurity here and what an important driver of voter choice that is. And it does strike me in the current context of pronounced, marked and sort of widespread economic insecurity, that work is more important than ever in terms of understanding how voters are behaving. There's one question here. I just need to mention it to you, Rob, saying, is there a way we can share the slides of yours that I spoke about? I mean, maybe you could tweet some of those slides out, or so. I don't know if you're willing to do that.
Very, very happy to. I can send them to you, Anand, as well, if you want to do anything with them. But I can
at Rob Ford Manx again, so look out for that if he tweets the photos out. But I haven't got
Rob is not mentioning it, but you can get most of this stuff through his Substack, so I'll promote it for
you. that's true. Available at all good websites.
Yeah, there's a lot of Thingometer, it's called.
There's a lot of people asking questions about what happens to the Conservative Party if they lose. So a little bit of speculation. I mean, you know, and the broad question is, do they sort of resurrect the One Nation Conservatives and become more liberal as a result of defeat, or do they become more right wing? Have a bit of a speculate for us, someone.
I mean, I'll start, and I should credit Tim Bale for some of my thinking on this, because he's been talking a lot about this recently. Think about what will happen. There'll probably be a leadership contest. It's hard to imagine that Rishi Sunak would stay on if it's a heavy defeat. If there's a leadership contest, the current rules mean two candidates go to the membership from the cohort of MPs. When you look at how the MPs behaved in the last contested leadership contest, it's very likely we get one candidate, maybe two candidates on the right of the party. And there's a very good chance that the membership, which is well to the right of the parliamentary cohort and well to the right of the average Conservative voter, will go with the more right wing, both economically and socially right wing. So it seems to me that the likeliest outcome, at least in the short term, is you end up with a leader who is to the right of the current leader and the shadow cabinet that's to the right of the current shadow cabinet. And if you look at the kind of people that are maneuvering themselves for that contest, Kemi Badenoch, Suella Braverman, and so on, that would be consistent with that. On the other hand, the Conservatives have surprised people in the past by showing a kind of survival instinct and instead going for someone that they think is a winner. So I think an awful lot depends on how Conservative members and MPs understand the nature of the defeat. And if you look at how they are talking about what they think is a coming defeat right now, an awful lot of it seems to be discourse along the lines of, we're not hardline enough, we're not right-wing enough, we've lost our sense of identity, we've lost our sense of direction, our narrative for what Britain's about. It doesn't sound like a party that thinks it wants to go back to the centre ground.
Yeah, that's interesting. And just, I mean, Paul and Sophie, I'm going to add another layer to this in case you have any information. Do we have any sense of what the remaining, I mean, assume a fairly significant loss for the Conservatives at the next election. Do we have a sense of who loses their seats and what that does to the ideological balance of the parliamentary party? Or is that not something that we know? I know it was something we meant to think about at some point, Sophie, but we never got around to it. But
you started it. Well, I do think the one thing I was going to add to what Rob said was that a lot of it will be dependent on the parliamentary party. I think that remains after the election and what that looks like. I think you saw that the recruitment of sort of those red wall Conservatives in 2019 had quite a big impact on sort of the ideological discourse that was going on within the Conservative Party and the type of issues they got hung up on and the divides in the party. So I think, you know, whoever's left, that will be a big determinant of that. In terms of who is going to be left, I think it's quite hard to tell because it looks like those northern seats are going to be, you know, gone. Let's assume that they're not part of that. So I don't necessarily think it will be the sort of economic preference mismatch in the party that we've had over the last few years. I don't think that will be an issue to the same extent. But in terms of, you know, the remainder of those seats, if you're losing a lot of sort of scattered shire seats and very traditional Tory seats, that's a real sort of hodgepodge mix of Conservatives that are left. So you might be left with sort of the Suella Bravermans, but you're also left with a few maybe quite traditional sort of centrist One Nation David Cameron-y Tories as well, so it's just quite hard to sort of think of an answer, and I think it will depend on just how badly the Tories do and what type of mix of Conservatives is left.
Interesting. Paula,
just to turn the question around the other way slightly, I mean, if the Conservatives and everything that I've seen, again reading Tim's work and what Sophie's just said, everything I've seen suggests that a reasonable size defeat will lead to attack to the right, both economically and socially. There's no voters there. So that makes the what looks at this stage as a difficult job for Labour going into government, if the Conservative Party wander off to the right, it makes that job for Labour an awful lot easier. It gives them an awful lot more space to make policy, to talk to voters and so on. So if they have a heavy defeat and go in that direction, it looks much more likely that Labour might be able to then, you know, be more successful as a government and secure a second term. Whereas if they were to try and actually understand where voters who might vote for them are, that might make things more difficult for Labour. So I think, you know, the whole thing is dynamic, but moving off to the right, I just don't know how many times you can say there's no voters there before somebody realises there's no voters there. It's just... Doesn't seem to ever quite cut through.
And there is such a difference between a government that comes in trying to cling to power and a government that comes in feeling comfortably enough to think in terms of two terms. I mean, you know, for those of us old enough to remember December 2019, it was very, very striking, wasn't it? That was a government that was thinking of the second and in some cases even the third term. I mean, obviously it didn't work out particularly well for them, but actually, if Starmer is able to come in and look at the opponents and think, you know what, I might have a bit more time and space here than I thought, that makes a real difference to how he sets about governing. But we have, unfortunately, run out of time. So without further ado, let me say a couple of things. Firstly, you can follow all these three on Twitter, at Rob Ford Manx, at Paula _Surridge, is that right? I'm doing this from memory, so if I get it wrong, _Surridge, and at Sophie Stowers. I think this is our last event until September, though I'm keeping my eye on the screen in case someone messages me and says I've got it totally wrong. We've got a whole load of stuff coming out in September on the TCA review, more lunch hour events. And if you want to be kept up to date on those, please subscribe to our newsletter. In the meantime, thank you so much to Sophie, to Paula, to Rob. Thank you all for tuning in. Have a very, very nice August, and we'll see you again refreshed and raring to go in September. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.